This is Wednesday, November 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. President-elect says he wants everyone to get along.
I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
But there are some who are having trouble doing that. Also ahead, Facebook, along with other social media sites, are having a problem with fake news. And the U.S. Secretary of State tries to convince an international climate change conference that the U.S. might go along. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, in just more than 2 months, Donald Trump will be inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States. One of Trump's key challenges will be balancing the campaign promises he made to his supporters while at the same time taking steps to heal the nation in the wake of a divisive personal campaign. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald Trump's stunning election victory still seems like a dream to some of his supporters, and Trump quickly sounded a note of reconciliation in his victory speech.
I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
But Trump's victory has been marred by protests around the country, from Oregon and California in the West to his home city of New York and to Massachusetts in the East.
I get disappointed, but this one scares me.
There have also been post-election incidents of intimidation targeting minorities and Muslims, something Trump was asked about in a CBS 60 Minutes interview.
I am so saddened to hear that, and I say stop it.
Healing the political divide is also a concern for President Barack Obama.
And it's really important to try to send some signals of unity and to reach out to minority groups or women or others that were concerned about the tenor of the campaign.
The political unrest comes as Trump begins to name his incoming government, including Republican Party Chair Reince Priebus as his chief of staff, and Stephen Bannon, a highly controversial journalist with a strong right-wing following, as his top political advisor. Trump's first major test is staffing the government, says John Fortier.
But the process of staffing a government is a big one in America. And as an outsider candidate, he does not have the traditional connections, the traditional people that an administration would have.
But Trump's ability to encourage national healing has more to do with the tone of his rhetoric, says Molly Reynolds.
We have sort of the sense of Trump that we've seen on the campaign trail, and then we have a slightly more muted version of Trump that we've seen come out from time to time. And the question of whether that latter form, that sort of pivot that we often anticipated but never quite saw during the presidential campaign, will that come out when he gets to the White House? We just don't know.
Thank you. God bless you, everybody.
Trump is expected to announce members of his cabinet in the weeks ahead, and who he appoints will also underscore the tone he wants to set as the incoming president. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
The Trump transition team continues its meetings at Trump Tower in New York City. VOA's Tina Trent has drawn the assignment of standing outside of the building, trying her best to find out what's going on inside. And Tina joins us now. Well, what have you found out about what's happening today, Tina?
Ira, I can tell you, unfortunately, not too much. We are roped. We're behind a rope line here right inside the front lobby of Trump Tower, right in front of the four elevators that lead up to his office and the executive suites. And so far, we know as much as what the press is reporting. We are stationed here throughout the day, trying to catch people as they come and go. It's almost like we're a bit like a celebrity paparazzi, and we're given information barely at all, really, unless we yell out to people and they want to come over. But for the most part, we are ignored. And we have to chase people down, but now they're even preventing us from doing that. So we're kind of roped behind this velvet rope and trying to grab people as they come and go. But it's hard process, and every once in a while we get a few answers, but they're the same as, they're pretty general, and it's basically, we're on track, transition team looks great. When you press them for specifics, no names other than the two appointments that we both know so far, which is Steve Bannon and Ryan Priebus.
And nothing else. So has anybody come out? Have you talked to anybody about what's going on? And I'm sorry, as I said, you drew the assignment, kiddo, and that's it. So anybody else tell you anything else?
Kellyanne Conway just got back from D.C. She was in D.C. meeting with the transition team over there and said that everything is looking good, that they're excited, that, you know, putting a government together is obviously takes a lot of work, and they're not ready to name names. We're just hoping for, you know, a hard and fast like date for any type of press conference, any type of official information. And yet there's still a bit of secrecy, you know, surrounding specifics here. And we're hard pressed to try and get more specific answers out of these folks, trying to get his aides as they come and go. And, you know, yesterday, for example, Mike Pence was in town and came through. One of his aides gave us the heads up that he was going to make a statement. He walked in, said nothing to us, walked straight into the elevators, took the elevators up. We waited all day for him to come down and maybe eventually make that statement that we were promised. At the end of the day, around 6 o'clock or so, he walked out and said nothing other than great day, great day. So this is kind of what we're working with at this point.
Well, we do know, and because nobody saw it, we're guessing that Trump went out for dinner with his family last night, but he didn't follow protocol. Mm-hmm. Explain that.
Yeah, we basically learned the remaining poolers who were here, they received an official lid, a quote-unquote lid, which indicates that there's no more official activity happening for the remainder of the evening, that reporters can essentially go home. So we received that lid, and yet after that lid occurred, was given to us, we found out through a tweet that he was actually having dinner at 21 Club, which is a local restaurant not too far away. And the remaining poolers who were here got in a cab, went to 21 Club. When they arrived, one of them called Hope Hicks, the press person, and she came out and said that we would have to be divided. The local New York press were able to go in, but people with no New York press tags had to remain outside. They were pushed further down the sidewalk and essentially trying to see what they could get as people were leaving. I think they managed to get a reaction from Ivanka Trump as she left the restaurant. But having to shout out questions from at least 150 feet away from the restaurant behind a dumpster, less. So this is kind of, there's no rules regarding this right now. We're told that they will eventually set up some type of briefing room, but we have no specific on timeline.
VOA's Tina Trinh outside Trump Tower, New York. Good luck, Tina.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Take care. Let's move on to another issue here. We all know about social media spread like wildfire across the globe, usurping other forms of communication, as a matter of fact. That is the focus of some controversy that has ensnared some social media sites, including Facebook. International Edition's social media guru, Andrew Palshevsky, is with us to talk about that. Andrew, this deals with news that's transmitted without any vetting. Is that right?
That's right. And the issue is really about how the news is being vetted. And I'll use Facebook as an example. Facebook, up until a few months ago, was using human editors to sift through news and figure out what was trending, what topics were the ones that people were talking about. And then Facebook got rid of those human editors because they had developed a program that could have a computer determine these things based on what these people were doing. Within that first week already, there was a news story that popped up that was a fake news story about Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly, of course, has battled Donald Trump throughout the campaign season. And so that's really the issue that we're seeing, is that how news is getting out to people, what news is getting out to people, is not necessarily reflective of what people are talking about. And keep in mind, too, that what I see on my Facebook feed and in my trending topics is going to be different from what you see in your trending topics. It depends on who you're friends with, what articles and links you click on. That all determines that.
So there are those who are worried that this is exacerbating the political division in the United States. How so? What is their reasoning here?
Well, I think it's exacerbating a lot of the, you know, kind of false stories that we're seeing, and it's kind of pushing people further into their corner, whether it's the left or the right. But in addition to exacerbating, I think it's exposing a lot of these things, particularly that people are less critical when it comes to social media. And when I say less critical, I mean they're less critical of where these stories are coming from, what the sources are. They're not exposing themselves to different sources of news. If you're a conservative, you're going to just look at conservative news, and your friends on Facebook and Twitter and other social media are primarily going to be conservative. If you're a liberal, it's the opposite. You're just going to look at liberal news, and your friends are going to be primarily liberal. So you kind of get into the social media bubble where you're not exposed to different things. And then on top of that, it's just the, you know, information age that we live in. People are so quick for information that they don't do their due diligence. And the example I always use is back in 2004, NPR had an April Fool's joke. They put up on their Facebook page, it says, "Why doesn't America read anymore?" And it was an article. And all these people shared it and said, "Oh, that's terrible. No one's reading anymore. It's awful." But if you clicked on the article, you would have said it said, "April Fools, this isn't a real article. It just shows how many people will share anything based on the headline and not actually look at what it is."
Well, maybe it should have been. What are these sites doing about this? Anything?
They're starting to do some things. Google has announced that it's going to ban fake news sites from using their advertising services, the idea being if they cut off the money, they cut off the misinformation. And Facebook has kind of done an about-face. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, has said previously that, "Oh, we didn't contribute to any of the election misinformation. Less than 1% of the news that's on Facebook is fake news." But now, according to the New York Times, they've come around after employees have questioned that assumption, and Facebook's not going to have ads on fake news sites, and they're going to also, like Google, try to cut off the money. So I think that is an acknowledgement by these sites that they are contributing to this, and they need to do something about this. They've kind of straddled that line between social media companies and news organizations, and so they need to make a clear stand on where they stand with that.
Boy, the whole landscape has changed. You and I assume you, and I know me, at least had Journalism 101, and then this is the first thing they teach you about not doing. You know?
Exactly. Yeah, it's the problem is one of the great things with social media, and I always say this, is that it gives so many people a voice that wouldn't have one. People can go viral, people can share their opinions.
Whether they deserve it or not.
And that's part of the problem, too, is that you have people who are sharing these opinions, but they're being taken as fact. They're being seen as an authoritative, credible source of information when it really is just an opinion. So kind of making that separation between fact and opinion is going to be really critical going forward.
Well, somebody, an old timer like me, has to say that some of these social sites have to have some vetting that goes into everything that goes in there, if that is at all possible.
And I think that's what they're recognizing slowly. It's going to be interesting to see how that develops and what they finally settle on, and also, again, straddling the line of free speech, because that's a criticism that they receive a lot when they start to vet these things and censor things. But they're going to have to do something.
You told me just a little while ago you found something on social media today that has something to do with this?
It does. A trending topic today is the term post-truth.
Now, post-truth?
Post-truth. This is the Oxford Dictionary.
Not a new cereal, I take it.
No, not post. Okay. No, it is not. It is Oxford Dictionary's 2016 Word of the Year. And this is the definition. It is relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. So in other words, all this fake news that we've been talking about could be considered post-truth. It's not factual, but appeals to people's emotions and gets them riled up. And a lot of people on social media talking about the fact that between Brexit and between Donald Trump's election, there's a lot of post-truth going on. There was a lot of information flying around on social media, or misinformation, as it were, and it involved or informed people's decision-making and how they decided to vote for a particular candidate or vote for or against Brexit. So post-truth, a very apropos word released this week.
Andrew Palczewski, again, thank you so much for the update on everything and the explanation of the rest.
My pleasure.
Talk
thank you.
Talk to you again tomorrow. This is VOA. Among the top stories in the world, with reports of internal clashes among his team and widespread speculation about who will be part of his cabinet, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump says that the process is transferring power from the Obama administration, that it's going fine, he says. Post-truth? Speaking in Greece, President Obama has emphasized the importance of the peaceful transition of power in the U.S. Russian President Vladimir Putin has decided his country is out of the International Criminal Court. And Secretary of State John Kerry tries to ease the minds of those who are concerned the next U.S. president will gut the historic global accord to mitigate climate change. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOANews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition on VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new preliminary study from the American Heart Association suggests that women with a history of migraines may also have an increased risk of stroke. Researchers in Florida studied over 900 women who, at the time, were being assessed for heart disease. Of the women studied, 224, or about 25% of them, reported a history of migraine headaches. The study suggests that compared to the women who did not report any migraines, those who did were found to have an 83% higher risk of some kind of cardiovascular event, such as either a stroke or heart attack, within an average 6-year follow-up. Compared to those who didn't have migraines, women with a history of migraine were also found to be a little more than twice as likely to suffer a stroke during the study. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Joyce Banda, the former president of Malawi. She'll discuss what Africa can learn from the U.S. elections and the peaceful transition of power from one leader to another. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Joining us from Marrakesh, Morocco, is VOA's chief diplomatic correspondent, Steve Herman. And Steve, John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State, had some quite interesting comments as far as climate change is concerned. You care to fill us in?
Yes, I think one of the major purposes of his speech here to a concerned audience was trying to say it may not be the end for the Paris Agreement, despite what the president-elect Donald Trump on the campaign trail had said about the climate change pact. President-elect Trump, of course, calling climate change a hoax. Secretary Kerry said that he couldn't speculate about what policies the president-elect will pursue, but he noted that during his time in public life, he learned that some issues look a bit different when you're actually in office compared to when you're on the campaign trail. And he said that climate change shouldn't be a partisan issue in the first place.
There's nothing partisan about climate change for the world scientists, who are near unanimous in their conclusion that climate change is real. It is happening. Human beings, for the most part, are causing it. And we will have increasing catastrophic impacts on our way of life if we don't take the dramatic steps necessary to reduce the carbon footprint of our civilization.
I can tell you that those in the audience, which included officials of a number of countries, representatives of the UN, even members of U.S. congressional committees, and of course environmentalists who were speaking among themselves, the topic of conversation, of course, was what would be the environmental policy of a President Trump?
Well, of course, he really, ever since he won the election, Trump has not commented on it. But what was the overall tone of those listening to John Kerry? And what's the overall tone of those attending this COP meeting?
Well, they're being hopeful. And I spoke with the executive director of Greenpeace International, the major environmental organization. And Jennifer Morgan told me that she has not felt fear among the international community attending COP22, that they believe that the goals of the Paris Agreement will not be jeopardized because other countries will make up for it. And other countries, notably Germany and China, will fill the leadership void. And the Chinese had a news conference here and basically said that in an official, another official of Greenpeace, who deals with their Chinese issues, says inside every crisis is an opportunity, and China has seized this. So we may be at this moment seeing a shift away from the United States to countries like China to take the lead on climate change mitigation, something that would have been unimaginable a decade ago.
Kerry seemed to, as I watched the speech this morning, seemed to have almost a wistful air about him. He's been put in an untenable situation and position here after the election results. Isn't that correct?
Well, certainly this is not what he expected when he set off for Antarctica during the week of the election. And this had been on the agenda, and this was supposed to be a valedictory speech on the environment for him. He did get a standing ovation at the beginning and the end. And, you know, he has very strongly championed for President Obama, the concerns about the environment. And to see this and potentially many other pursuits and accomplishments of his tenure as Secretary of State be reversed in the next administration, of course, is giving him some concern. I spoke with him yesterday in Abu Dhabi before we flew here to Marrakesh. And, in his public comments, he's putting the best face forward.
Steve Herman is BOA's chief diplomatic correspondent. He joins us from Marrakesh, Morocco. Thanks again, Steve. This is VOA's International Edition. Recent interracial police shootings across the United States and the protests that followed have reopened some old wounds and highlighted racial inequities in American society. Well, now a documentary movie aimed primarily at young people attempts to open a dialogue on the issues surrounding this most sensitive of areas in American culture. VOA's Jeff Custer spoke with one of the film's creators as well as students who have seen the film.
Race has always been there. People need to see that. Instead of ignoring it and trying to be like, there's no segregation, there's no slavery, it's still here though, and people need to know.
The film, I'm Not Racist, Am I?, follows 12 New York City high school students over 9 months as they participate in exercises and sometimes difficult discussions that directly address the bias they deal with on a daily basis.
One kid said to me that, like, oh, I thought all Asians are supposed to be smart, like, what's wrong with you?
Not in theaters. The film is being shown exclusively to groups of young people and their parents. The film's director, Catherine Wigginton Green, says parents tend to find the film especially challenging.
They are really seeing that, you know, kids maybe are going to dances or have friends with kids who are different race. And so they think, oh, they just have it all figured out. But what we realized in making the film is that kids don't, and they're not talking about it with their families.
The film has been screened repeatedly at Woodrow Wilson High School, a large multicultural public school in Washington, D.C. Principal Kimberly Martin says her students needed to see it.
From the first day that I was in this school, I could not believe that there are classrooms that are all African American or all Latino, and then there are classrooms that are all white.
Student James Sorokin agreed that a diverse school population does not necessarily translate to racial integration.
I think that, honestly, like, white kids hang out with white kids here and black kids hang out with black kids generally.
The film convinced student Amilcar Hudson that talking about racial issues like self-segregation is the best way to address them. But he acknowledges that talking about race remains a challenge.
I mean, I think that's the scariest part about it. I understand that there's a racial problem in this country, but the fact that people don't really feel comfortable talking about it means that we're almost subconsciously satisfied with it and we're okay with this going on.
I understand it's so hard to hear that you are inherently racist because of something you can't control, but isn't it worse to hear that you are less than people inherently because of the color of your skin?
Students at Wilson High have formed a group called Common Ground to encourage interaction and discussion among students of different cultural backgrounds. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps us up for today on International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now, on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our thanks to Director Diane Gao, our engineer Sidrak Franklin. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a great day.